Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally explained to you in plain English. Promise. Hello and welcome to your friendly neighborhood economist for September 9, 2014, show number 027. Is it hot in here or is it me? This month, I talk about the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed carbon regulations and the reactions they've received. Also, the usual mix of local, state, and national news. So buckle up. Your friendly neighborhood economist is in. First, local news. On the employment front, while unemployment rates in Greene and Columbia County continue to be significantly lower than last year, over the same period, the actual number of people employed still didn't change much at all in either county. So once again, the drop in the unemployment rate is due to fewer people in the labor force rather than to a broader economic recovery in the area. And we still can't tell if there are fewer people because they've all left or they've just left the labor force. In business news, the sale of land to Ginsburg's has been much in the news this last month. Details of the contract signed between Columbia County and Ginsburg's were released. Ginsburg's gets the 33 acres of land for a dollar and is under the obligation to build 60,000 square feet of structure within 3 years and operate on the site for 10 years. Penalties would go up to the value of the land, or $280,000. While the plan has been criticized by residents of Claverick, Ken Flood, the Planning and Economic Development Commissioner for Columbia County, defended it. Ginsburg CEO David Ginsburg also defended the deal, saying he could easily have built the facility elsewhere. Criticisms include the sale for only a dollar, as well as the payment in lieu of taxes that's part of the deal. There's also opposition to the variances Ginsburg wants for the refrigeration facility, as it wants to build to a height of 50 feet, 15 more than the actual limit. In other local business news, the Greene County Industrial Development Agency's executive director, Renee Van Schaak, told the Catskill Town Board that two areas in Catskill were potential spots for an IDA project: the old cement plant, Holcim, on the south side of town, and the area near the thruway exit. That's once the sewer district is created. In energy news, Central Hudson Gas and Electric is seeking to raise rates by 4.4% next year, which would mean an average customer would see an increase of $4.78 per month on their bill. CHG&E is seeking the increase in order to finance upgrades to its delivery systems. The request, which is submitted to the New York Public Service Commission, may take close to a year to be processed. This would be on top of the rate increase created by the new capacity zone created by the Federal Energy Regulatory Committee, FERC. The point of that increase was to raise prices in order to promote private investment in greater electricity generation capacity to alleviate supply problems downstate. CHG&E is opposing the new capacity zone, but still asking for higher rates to pay for infrastructure upgrades for their own delivery system. Meanwhile, the Champlain-Hudson Power Express transmission line project, first proposed in 2008, has received approval at the federal level as the Department of Energy has finished its environmental impact assessment of the project. This project would carry 1 gigawatt of energy from Canada to New York City via lines buried underneath the beds of Lake Champlain and the Hudson River. The portion that goes through our listening area will be buried underground along CSX rights-of-way through the towns of New Baltimore, Coxsackie, Athens, and Catskill. This is distinct from the West Point project, on which there will hopefully be more next month. On the municipal finance front, the future of the Durham Elementary School is now being explored with some interest from an area veteran service group. The Ichabod Crane Central School District will be getting $926,000 back from Questar 3, but will be paying more for Questar's services as a result. The Germantown Central School District learned it was in fact to receive funding for its pre-kindergarten program in the first year of the governor's statewide full-day pre-K program. The Kendra Hoek Memorial Library is seeking a ballot referendum for voters to improve increasing their support from the towns of Stuyvesant and Kinderhook in order to do some much-needed renovations there. The town board in Lexington authorized the solicitation of bids to build a wastewater treatment system in the town after a long process that began in the late 1990s. In Hudson, the site of Foster's Refrigeration at 119 North 2nd Street has been named a state brownfield site, meaning the city of Hudson may now qualify for funding to help clean the site up, a process that was ready to begin in 2007 before the financial crisis and recession put a stop to funding. So thanks for that also, Wall Street. Although the city of Hudson is eyeing the 33 acres of land behind the high school for housing development, the school district reminded the city this month that there are already plans for that land, including solar power installations and an indoor sporting facility. A report released by the New York State Comptroller's Office in August detailed the results of a payroll audit of Columbia County's financial records. Apparently, the county paid $18,724 to employees for time not worked or for leave time taken but not charged. There was an additional $24,824 in leave time taken but not charged. Oops. Columbia County Board of Supervisors Chairman Patrick Rattan from Kinderhook agreed with most of the audit's findings in a written response, saying the county, quote, should adopt comprehensive written policies and procedures outlining countywide requirements for employee time and attendance and leave accruals, unquote. I guess so. The report is based on an audit covering county payroll practices from January 1, 2012 to October 3, 2013. In news of our crumbling infrastructure, repairs have completed in Stockport on the Stottville Bridge, which carries County Route 82 over the Claver Creek. Meanwhile, Columbia County has received $750,000 from the state for repairs to the Route 22 bridge over the Rolf Jansen Kill in Hillsdale. It's still not known when construction will start there. In other bridge news, the Columbia County Economic Development Committee discussed plans to repair the Ferry Street Bridge near Hudson's waterfront. That repair may cost as much as $2 million when all costs are added up. In other news, the Athens Cultural Center needs to make some serious renovations to the village-owned building they occupy to the tune of about $100,000. They're looking into possible sources of funding. A community block grant, community development block grant would be just the thing, I think. In Hudson, the Galban Foundation has received $3.4 million in grants for its project to renovate the Armory Building into the new Hudson Area Library, Hudson Senior Center, and the Perfect 10 After School program that promotes reading for high potential girls in Hudson. 3 years and $17 million later, Greene County has completed all Irene-related road repairs just in time for hurricane season. Speaking of flooding, Greene County has begun planning for the risks from future flooding. The Catskill Waterfront Resiliency Task Force presented its findings at a meeting on Tuesday, August 20th. Much of Catskill is in danger from global warming-induced sea level rises. Just a 3-foot increase will inundate the point. The task force report took 9 months to complete and assesses risks and solutions to the problems associated with the recent history-making floods in Greene County. Some of the proposed solutions included relocating houses from West Main Street, reviewing and updating the village emergency plan, relocating the wastewater treatment plant, and building a pier out to the point, and allowing the land by Dutchman's Landing to revert back to wetlands. The task force also looked at the Bushnell neighborhood and suggested extending the riverfront greenway or raising the road to act as a flood protector. The report will eventually be made available online at the Catskill Library as well, I'll have a link to their website in the show notes, available as always on my blog, Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook.
Side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on six crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of seven sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, a hard rain. Gonna fall. And what did he see? My blue-eyed son. And what did he see? My darling young one. I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves around it. Saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. And I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, a hard rains are gonna fall. You hear my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve. I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. Heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. Because it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, a hard rains are gonna fall.
That was Bob Dylan with A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Hard to believe that's Bob Dylan's voice. Don't smoke, kids. And if you think I'm being flippant about the impact of Tropical Storm Irene, don't. I'm dead serious about that and the storm that's coming our way due to global warming. Now in New York State news, although the towns of Dryden in Tompkins County and Middlefield in Otsego County won their case to ban fracking in their towns at the State Appeals Court, a lawyer for the gas companies is appealing the decision. It's not clear if the State of Court of Appeals will reopen the case. It's under no obligation to do so and will only rehear cases if it finds it got facts or the law wrong. It's not clear that they did in this case. Education groups, backed by labor, issued a report stating that New York is about $5.9 billion short of promised education funding. Under a court ruling from 2006, the state was ordered to increase funding by $5.5 billion, but has since the recession actually cut funding, so that this year's total shortfall is close to $6 billion, or about $300 per New York resident. The governor claims that more spending doesn't produce better results, but the wealthy, who generally pay high fees to send their kids to private schools and, coincidentally, favor lower taxes, apparently haven't heard that. Meanwhile, we found out last month that school pension costs will be increasing 7.8% this year. This is the flip side of the story on the pensions and highway trust fund we heard about last month. the low interest rates are making it hard for public pension systems to keep up with their future obligations, since they're not making as much money on their safe investments as they were before. They have to pay more, and the options for doing that are to cut in other areas, like the classroom or administration, or ask for tax increases. Both of those are very popular options, are they not? That's a bit of sarcasm there. If you'd like to comment on casino proposals, there are three dates coming up to do so. The Albany hearing will be September 22nd, the Poughkeepsie event will be September 23rd, and the Ithaca event will be September 24th. All of those dates run from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. So if you want to find out about the proposals, you can do so at the State Gaming Commission's website, www.gaming.ny.gov. If you have children or own a home, you'll be getting money from the state. All thanks to your sugar daddy, Governor Cuomo. Hey, did you know who's up for re-election this fall? What a coincidence. His opponent, Rob Astorino, apparently doesn't think that's a coincidence. What do you think? Speaking of Rob Astorino's run for the governor's mansion, his jobs plan, which he let be known this past month, is to allow fracking, which will create jobs when we require a lot of people to clean up the environmental disaster resulting from it. Oh, and also to cut governmental spending, which will reduce the number of government employees. Wait, what? You get to decide for yourself how this compares with Cuomo's big casino idea or the Teach Out Woo campaign's economic agenda. Economic fairness, a higher minimum wage first and foremost, a 21st century internet, although there are no concrete proposals about how to get there, stopping concentration of economic power, such as the Time Warner Comcast merger, and investing in infrastructure. The first and last points certainly worked for me in terms of jobs, while the middle two were good but short on specifics. Frankly, the biggest winner on the jobs front for my money is the governor's universal pre-K initiative, which is not only creating jobs for pre-K teachers and staff, but also freeing up the time of parents, especially mothers, which will do a lot to improve the relative economic well-being of women in the state. Don't forget to vote today. Polls open at noon for the primary. We also learned this month that the governor plans to consolidate the state's many different solo programs into one, the NY Sun Incentive Program. It makes sense to have the effort coordinated, and the goal of increasing the solar power generation in the state by 3 gigawatts is a good and achievable goal. Speaking of worthy and achievable goals, here's a clip from Laura Flanders' show with Chris Michael on workplace democracy in New York City.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. In fiscal year 2013, New York City procured $16.5 billion, with a B, worth of supplies and construction services. But none of those dollars flowed into a New York City cooperative business. Why not? Well, that's a question raised by our next guest at a recent New York City Council hearing on the value of worker co-ops. Chris Michael is the executive director of the New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives. It helps worker cooperatives get started and a whole lot more. If the city really wants to reduce inequality, he told the hearing, it would be smart to change some policies. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So $16.5 billion, what could New York City's worker co-ops do with that kind of cash?
Well, certainly that could provide for thousands upon thousands of democratic jobs in the first place.
What do you mean by a democratic job? What does a dollar in a co-op do that's different from a dollar in a different kind of business?
Well, so in the first place, when a revenue or income is provided to a worker cooperative, it provides for a workplace or an environment where decisions are made democratically, where you don't have one class of individuals, namely investors, controlling the fates, the minds, the bodies of another class of individuals, i.e. the workers. Moreover, in very sort of narrow, dollar terms, right? When a dollar is paid into a worker cooperative, when you consume a product or the services of a worker cooperative, that money is going to be divided equitably among the workers. So there are certain sort of hard decisions that need to be made about wages, for example. You might have somebody who's highly trained who sort of in our market demands a higher wage or higher salary. But then you also have decisions that are made about sort of end of year surplus or profits, and usually those decisions are made really quite sort of in a very immediate egalitarian fashion.
And you described a couple of worker co-ops when you spoke at the New York City Council hearing. Yeah. Here's a clip of what you had to say.
Okay. New York City can take an active hand in helping to incubate, create, provide the business planning, not just the financing, right? Not just an open door for somebody to sit down in a chair and get a pat on the back, but for New York City to provide a direct and active hand in doing the business planning, the foreplanning, the advanced planning to create these businesses, to then go to the workforce roles, to do the hiring, to hire the senior managers, the professionals that will also be necessary for a major construction business. We really have an opportunity to really make our mark here as far as New York City Council. We have an opportunity to really set a new national standard. This really is something that's new. The Bay Area, Cleveland, Chicago, they're not doing what we're about to do.
There are conditions that make it easier or more difficult for co-ops to thrive. Part of the point of the hearing was to flesh out what some of those might be. Yeah. What did you learn? What did you hope the council learned? Yeah. And, well, what do we know about what makes a city co-op friendly?
Sure. Well, I think the best example of a city that's co-op friendly is the city of Bologna in Italy, right? And in that city, about 80 to 90% of the social services that the city provides to its public are essentially contracted out through worker cooperative businesses. So right now, already in the United States, we have something, you know, we call it third-party government. You know, we have this incredible vast system in which the government doesn't necessarily directly provide services to its citizenry, but actually contracts out and, you know, purchase. It doesn't form its own construction company, right? We don't have the construction company of New York City. Rather, we hire other construction companies to do the work for us. So in the city of Bologna, the worker cooperative community has leveraged this to their advantage. And I think that we're perfectly capable of doing that here at home.
Tell us some more about New York City's co-ops. I mean, A, how many are there? And what kind of things do they do?
Sure. Well, in the first place, you can find a fantastic listing of the worker cooperatives here in New York City on our homepage, nycworker.coop, and there's a business directory. These are, after all, businesses.
Now, you make it sound like an enormous number, but last time I looked, it was like 23.
That's right. It's a very small number of worker co-ops, and there's still a very small number of worker co-ops nationally. So we have about, you know, we have a sizable fraction of the U.S.'s worker co-ops are here located at home in New York City, but still a very burgeoning phenomenon.
So, but if they're so great, why are there so few of them?
Well, that speaks to all sorts of issues with regards to the culture here in the United States, education around business, state support for cooperative incubators and cooperative institutions like New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives.
So where do you think the biggest challenges lie for moving the needle on this question, getting us from 23 to, I don't know, 123 co-ops in the next few months?
Sure. Well, you know, I think that this is certainly a multi-year vision. Fundamentally, what my organization advocates, and I think what worker cooperative, you know, advocates nationally and internationally advocate, is really moving the conversation about our economy to a very different place. We're not merely advocating that it would be nice or it would be fun or it would be good to have worker cooperatives. We're arguing ultimately that this is sort of a moral imperative, that really every employee, every worker, every human being has a right to democracy in the workplace. Now, in terms of moving the conversation in that direction, you know, that's going to take decades, you know, maybe even centuries. In terms of taking some very bold steps in that direction, I can't think of a better thing than the conversation that we're having right now with New York City Council, with New York City Economic Development Corporation, with New York City Small Business Services Department, and thinking about the ways in which we can integrate our democratic government with building democratic businesses.
Why is this conversation coming up as it is right now?
Well, I think that progressives, you know, sort of writ large, have had a major victory with Mayor de Blasio. So I think that we're seeing a real, you know, city council, city government is really receptive to these ideas in a way that they likely wouldn't have been under previous administrations.
And the data that you point at to suggest that co-ops are a rational and effective response to the inequality that we see in our mm-hmm. society?
So purely in terms of numbers, right? So you have on the one hand, right, you have just sort of, one might have, one need not necessarily have, but one might have a sort of a moral impetus or a moral feeling that humans shouldn't be rented out by other humans, mm-hmm. right? That humans should democratically control their own businesses in partnership with their fellow workers. Now, in economic terms, you see around the world, internationally, certain ethical standards which are in place in worker cooperatives. And those ethical standards generally insist upon an approximately 8-to-1 ratio between the highest paid employee, say, let's call that person the CEO of the company, and the lowest paid person in the firm. Of course, those are radically different numbers than we are really conditioned to accept as normal here in the United States, mm-hmm. where we have a ratio of at least 475-to-1, if not higher, in the last fiscal year. And there's, of course, a very good reason why worker cooperatives are allowed to impose an ethical standard which allows for an 8-to-1 pay ratio, and that's because they're democratically controlled by their workers.
Mm-hmm. Final questions. I was just in Chicago, where I've been covering the story of the what used to be the Republic Windows and Doors factory, now the New Era Windows.
Yeah.
I saw them. They're set up. The place is beautiful.
Yeah.
They need business.
Yeah.
And they are very hard up for contracts in a global economy.
Yeah.
They are undercut on every front.
Yeah.
What makes you believe that a co-op mm-hmm. can function in a capitalist economy?
Sure. So on the one hand, we have concrete examples of firms like the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation with 80,000 members or worker members, and they've been competing quite successfully in the global capitalist marketplace for decades now, making everything from, you know, racing bicycles to home pressure cookers that you make food with. On the other hand, the realities of the competitiveness of the global capitalist marketplace, there's something that worker cooperators, people who believe in a democratic economy, have to sort of reckon with, and it's precisely. It's precisely for that reason that I think that it's extremely important that we start to look at what can be done with public spending. The city should clarify that worker cooperatives are an extremely important tool to combat economic inequality, that worker cooperative businesses are treated as given sort of preferred contractor status, mm-hmm. and ultimately that contracting targets are set every year, and hopefully incrementally those targets increase, but that every year 5% or 10% or 20% and maybe one day 100% of city spending will have to be channeled through worker cooperative democratic businesses.
Not to do anybody any favors, but simply if you've stated as your goal reduction of inequality and poverty, it's one effective way to go.
Yes.
I've got to ask you, as you mentioned Mondragon and its success, there is the more depressing news that in a global economy, their biggest factory, and it's a network of factories, but Fagor declared bankruptcy.
Yeah,
does that
right.
ruin your argument?
I don't think in the slightest bit. I mean, as far as I understand, about half of those employees of Fagor have already been brought in as employees in other parts of the company. Mondragon is an incredibly dynamic, democratically run business. And, you know, that's part of life, it's part of business, it's part of human need, right? We no longer want flip phones, we want iPhones. So if the flip phone division gets shut down, well, then you bring those workers into, you know, the smartphone division. So I don't really think ultimately it's any kind of large problem.
All right, so look ahead, last question, look ahead 5 years, or take 10, I'll be generous.
Oh, give me 10.
What do you want to see in place in this city? Whether it's anchor institutions or new protected mm-hmm. markets for co-ops mm-hmm. or new educational possibilities mm-hmm. and training, new property perhaps. Mm-hmm. What do you want to see mm-hmm. that would leave you to think your work had been well done?
Yeah. I think the number one thing that could be achieved in the next 10 years would be that we've established certain contracting goals on the part of the city, that those contracting goals are set in a progressive manner to increase over time, and to complement those contracting targets, that the city is providing money, financing, and resources to develop businesses tailored to those contracting goals.
This is a great idea that I'm interested in helping to implement in this area. I think one obvious application would be Pine Haven. If the current workforce could take on the running of the place from the county, the jobs and the money would stay in the county rather than be transported into some large corporate bank account somewhere else. I'd love to talk to any Pine Haven workers interested in doing something like this. That's yfneconomist@gmail.com if you're listening.
Is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure cranes finish 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow, with names like benzene and formaldehyde. You better keep it far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below the groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Subway. Oh, that was frack. We're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
So it all goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was frack, baby, frack until the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was up to the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Sick people couldn't prove fracking was to blame. All the while, water wells were going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane released. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong, could lead to climate change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reduce the toxins contained, the gas and wastewater, and the people will get sick, and the planet will get hotter.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
That was The Fracking Song, My Water's on Fire Tonight, just dropping some knowledge on you in the form of music, courtesy of Studio 20 NYU in collaboration with ProPublica.org. Now for U.S. news. You may have heard that our old friend Paul Ryan, late of the humiliating defeat at the hands of Joe Biden in the last vice presidential debate,
with all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey,
is back with another thrilling plan to save hungry children from the humiliation of being fed by the government. He knows they'd rather starve. Freedom! More specifically, Ryan has another budget plan with some interesting, if predictable, details. This is part of the Republican Party's plan to continue to bamboozle poor white folks into voting for them and hopefully to pick up some of the more gullible folks of color. The big agenda item is what they are calling opportunity grants. So they must be good, right? Well, these are block grants to the states in lieu of all the different program-specific support payments that they currently receive. This is not, according to Ryan, about reducing spending, just reforming it. One big check instead of bunches of littler ones. What could possibly go wrong? Glad you asked. Here are a few things. First and foremost, I think it's safe to say that the guy who has consistently proposed and voted for cuts to things like food stamps and Social Security may not have the best interests of the poor people at heart, no matter how much he tries to convince them to vote his party back into power. Then, of course, states might be able to spend the money on things other than feeding poor children, or just replace the money they're now spending on state programs with this money from the feds. Whatever they call an anti-poverty program would do the trick, right? Look, as Charlie Pierce reminds us, we're talking about states that turned down free money to expand their Medicaid coverage, which decision will cost thousands of poor people their lives. Also, it's a lot easier to cut one big check than to cut a lot of little ones with specific programs attached to them. This also has the advantage of turning different slices of those who receive social welfare against each other as they fight over the scraps. It's a lot harder to sell increasing a vague thing like opportunity block grants than food stamps, and look how difficult that is anymore. One thing that's okay with me is increasing the earned income tax credit. It's a proven program that helps the working poor, especially if they're parents. However, it does nothing at all for those who can't find a job. Here's the thing, though. There are a lot of people who consider the poor to be lazy and stupid, and so deserving nothing better than poverty. People like Sean Hannity come right out and say that. Paul Ryan, in Unguarded Moments, criticizes an urban culture of poverty. Let me just note that the thing that neither one of these idiots is coming right out and saying is that they want you to think of black people when you think of the poor, despite the fact that most poor people are in fact white. How about that? Do you suppose they don't know that? A cynic might almost say that they were trying to use race as a way to turn the poor against each other. Fascinating. I honestly don't know what these two alleged Catholics got out of their religion, other than the feeling of moral superiority. I got that too. Jesus was actually quite clear on the subject of poverty and wealth, at least according to that book. But I digress. They take what is one part of at least one poor person's story and make it the whole story. All you need is hard work and determination not to be poor. I'm sure that somewhere there is a poor person who is poor because they didn't work hard enough. This is the land of opportunity, after all. They leave out that it is the land of opportunity as long as you're lucky. Here's the problem with this story in general, as laid out by Matt Brunick, and this is a good takedown of the mainstream economic theory about why there's poverty and how income is distributed. Their conception of success is that it is directly due to economic productivity, where there is no interference in the market. There are some real problems with this, though. The value that nature provides, and that is the private property of someone, is not earned, and the ownership of valuable natural resources is highly concentrated and very profitable. Very little that is produced is done by just one person working on their own, and so just a result of their own personal effort. And very little of the value that is produced is controlled by the person that actually produces it. About one-third of the value produced in our society flows to people who do not work, but who just own capital. The proponents of this way of thinking then would fall back on the economic theory that distribution is based on the marginal product of capital and labor. But then there's still all the knowledge and technology that also goes into the production that the owners and producers of which don't get paid for either. And of course, the capital, other than the land, is all produced by people who didn't get the value of what they produced. What their theory or prejudice or whatever you want to call it blinds these people to is that a lot of, if not all of, the poor work very hard indeed and get very little back for their labor.
You're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. You at home, and they hit you at school.
tortured and scared you for 20 odd years.
That was Marianne Faithfull with Working Class Hero. And now, our doomed future. As promised last time, I'm going to tell you a little bit about global warming and the U.S.'s timid, maybe too little, too late response. First, some cheery news about the unfolding evidence and impacts of global warming. As you may have heard, this past May, the U.S. government released its annual National Climate Assessment, which made news because of its emphasis on the impacts the U.S. is already seeing from global warming. Heat waves and droughts in the Midwest, Texas, and now California are affecting food production, while in other parts of the country, heavier rainfalls have been leading to flooding and also problems with food production. Another report was released in June by a bipartisan group, including former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Hank Paulson and Robert Rubin, Treasury Secretaries under George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, respectively. Their focus was on the risks of global warming to the value of stocks in publicly traded corporations, and they urged that risk should be disclosed in light of their report's findings, which echo the climate assessment, although even more dire since they're looking at the next several decades and not what's just happening now. Last month, I described the proposed regulations. It's a set of carbon emission reduction targets for individual states to meet that take into account their current reliance on fossil fuels, together with each state's ability to come up with their own plan to meet the target, subject to EPA approval. There's a link in the show notes for the brave among you who want to actually read the proposal, the proposed rules. Now then, what are level-headed, serious-minded people saying about the proposed regulations? Who knows? But the Chamber of Commerce has scary numbers for you to be scared about. The Chamber's study found that over the next 16 years, the regulations will cost $50 billion. Wow, that does sound scary, doesn't it? Of course, over the same period, the U.S. economy is projected to produce $21.5 trillion, which is about $70,000 for everybody in the U.S. today. So the cost to substantially reduce emissions of carbon in the atmosphere is going to be less than a quarter of 1% of output for the next 16 years. I'll take that deal. And I'm betting the chamber's got a goat behind curtain number two. I guarantee it. There's also this priceless quote from The Hill, the newspaper. Quote, the top environmental regulator in Texas said that the state may choose not to follow the Environmental Protection Agency's rules limiting carbon pollution from power plants, unquote. Also, they'll sue. In case you don't know the history of nullification, which is what this is, the idea that states can ignore federal laws that they don't like, it goes back to the pre-Civil War era and helped lead to that war, since many of the federal laws the southern states wanted to ignore had to do with slavery. But why let that stop us now? Just because it's settled law. This is toddler temper tantrum stuff. Try saying that five times fast. Texas is going to hold its breath until that mean old federal government starts acting more lawless, as in not enforcing the Clean Air Act. And Texas will not be alone in this particular example of the stupid. Then there are the predictable reactions from Republicans and some coal state Democrats as well in Congress. They characterize the proposed rule as another example of what they call the president overreaching and exceeding his authority. Unfortunately for this argument, the Supreme Court ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency does indeed have the power to limit carbon emissions under the Clean Air Act, which was passed by Congress and signed by the president in the 1970s. And I think that the executive branch is supposed to enforce the laws that Congress passes. Yes? Am I missing some vital detail here? What's that you say? Somebody wrote in the fine print at the end of the Constitutions that all bets are off if the president's black? You don't say. I don't remember that from my physics class. Executive overreach is simply another way of saying doing things that the Republicans don't like, which is to say doing anything at all other than losing the last two elections. There are some more serious contributions, of course. One problem with the plan is that it is not ambitious enough. We simply cannot burn more than about one-third of already proven reserves of oil, coal, and gas if we want to prevent catastrophic climate change. Ever. It has to stay in the ground. The president's plan reduces emissions to 30% below their 2005 level by 2030. It's better than nothing, maybe? Of course, we've already reduced our emissions by 16% compared to 2005 levels, although some of that's due to the continuing economic slowdown. But globally, levels are much higher, led by China's growth in emissions from coal. If we don't do more than is on offer, how can we convince China and India to come along? Another problem with the plan, as I see it, is something that a lot of people are seeing as a positive. The plan will shift our energy production away from coal and to natural gas. While gas definitely burns more cleanly, both in terms of carbon and of other things that are directly harmful to humans, like mercury, the extraction of natural gas is increasingly coming through fracking, which, besides the contamination of water and the production of earthquakes involved with the process, also releases a lot of methane directly into the atmosphere through leaking. Natural gas, or methane, is a much stronger greenhouse gas than carbon. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long as carbon does, but the more natural gas we frack, the more of it gets into the atmosphere to heat things up. In addition, this will keep a lot of existing nuclear reactors online since they are very low carbon emitters. And although nuclear reactors are less detrimental to human health than coal-fired power plants, they do have a much greater potential for catastrophic events, such as Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. Name one coal power plant disaster. Another consideration is that there are people currently employed in the coal biz who will not be employed in the coal biz in the future as a result of this plan. That's unfortunate, for sure, especially for those people. However, I think it is not a coincidence that such people live in areas with some of the highest poverty rates in the country. So I don't think working coal is doing a lot of good for those communities, personally. And I think that when legislators from places like Kentucky and West Virginia go ballistic at the mere mention of maybe reducing the use of coal, The real concern is for the corporations in the coal biz in those states, rather than the workers who work for them. 4.2% of West Virginia workers are currently in the coal biz, and 0.6% in Kentucky are. Every other state is far behind that. Would it not perhaps be better to find something useful for those folks to do, rather than remove mountaintops to get at the dirty, world-destroying fuel lying underneath them? It's a fair question, I think. The EPA itself delivers some numbers that seem questionable. Speaking of problems, they report that the new rule will have a net benefit of $67 billion a year by 2030, or something like $150 per person per year in the U.S., depending on how much population there is at the time. That sounds pretty good, but the EPA's net benefits come mostly from reduction in health effects from other harmful associated emissions with burning fossil fuels in the U.S., and from global benefits of reducing carbon emissions. That last one seems a fishy thing to do, and it highlights the global free rider problem that is global warming. Everyone benefits from my reduction, but the cost is all mine. This is the problem that keeps individual nations from acting first. China doesn't want to do it if we don't. We don't want to do it if China doesn't. India doesn't want to do it if neither one of us does, etc., etc. That's why we need international agreements to all do this before we all drown.
Thank you. to their egos, they cold start fronting. If you're scared of what we'll do, I don't need you to understand why I'm fuming, but you'd be a better person if you got that I'm human. The books best known to lie, kill, and ravage are the ones that's working hard to spread the word that I'm a savage. Everyday lynching is plain, don't phase ya, but just watching OJ walk sure pains ya. Don't want a riot, don't push no further. You wanna get on, what's the time to get away with murder? American apartheid's fucked up, so cease. Often said, still true, no justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
In light of recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, Staten Island, New York, and really everywhere else, I thought I'd give you MC Justice with Innocent Until Proven Black, the second track of Justice's 1998 album, Utter Subversion. Fun fact, MC Justice is now Adam Balm and fronts Dharmacology, a psychedelic funk trio out of Oakland, California. You can find Dharmacology on Facebook. Link in the show notes. That's all for this month. Join me next time for more news and perhaps an interview with Jeanette Lim on the economics of minimum wages. Also, don't forget to donate during our Radio Love Pledge Drive from September 18th to the 30th. Your pledge helps keep shows like this one on the airwaves, so show your radio love by chipping in some of your hard-earned dough. Your friendly neighborhood economist, out. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the second Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. or at any time online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook, just search for your friendly neighborhood economist, on my new homepage at yfneconomist.blogspot.com, where I'll post show notes and links to the show, on my Tumblr blog at yfneconomist.tumblr.com, or on Twitter at yfneconomist. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, ask me through one of these avenues or email me at yfneconomist@gmail.com. I'm always happy to hear and answer questions, so please send them in. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is a production of WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, New York, and Thomas Masterson.